Good morning again. My name is Pamela Mukaire, and I'm going to be talking to you about the experiences of young people living with HIV/AIDS in Uganda. And very quickly, I will let you know that I have no relationship with this clause, financial or otherwise. The objectives for today, we are going to I'm going to quickly highlight the ethical dilemmas that HIV young adults face in trying to strike the balance between survival and continuing to practice or reducing HIV transmission among their peers or other people. I'm going to also explain to you briefly what the challenges are for managing HIV, and then I'm going to talk to you a little about what they propose HIV interventions should include to improve their livelihoods. A quick background: between 1982 and 2008, Uganda had about 26 million people infected with HIV. About 1.6 million had lost their lives, and in 2005 alone, about 290 people were sick enough to require antiretroviral initiation, and about 210 people died every day from HIV. So between individuals between the ages of 15 to 49, for that age group, AIDS is the leading cause of death in the country, and life expectancy drops to about 8 years. So why do we care about young people? Currently in Uganda, young adults between ages 15 to 24 are having the greatest number of current infections in HIV. And then their prevalence rate is 3% compared to the national prevalence rate of 6.4%. So that's a very big issue. And then especially for young women, their vulnerability increases because they are 3 to 6 times more likely to get infected from HIV than their male counterparts. So the aim of the study was to describe and document young people's experiences living with HIV/AIDS, but like I said, to also hear from them what their recommendations or suggestions were for improving interventions for the prevention and management of HIV. And the way I did the recruitment, I posted flyers at treatment centers in 3 districts in the country. And then quickly after posting flyers and only getting 1 participant, it occurred to us that there might be participants that want to come, but they cannot read. And that was something that we didn't think about before the study began. So then we used radio announcements, and as soon as the announcements went through the districts, we actually had participants identify and look for me as a researcher. The structure of the study design, the structure, we used narrative approach, which is basically interviews. You conduct interviews for whatever length of time the participants want to talk, and depending on how they feel and where they are at, they can come back and do another interview. And the reason this was important is because in structural interview narratives, you allow the young person to retell their story over and over again, because for some of them it's the first time they're hearing their story and constructing meaning around their HIV experience. And the interviews were about 45 minutes to an hour. One of them was 3 hours. So I had a questionnaire of 73 questions that I went through, and basically I was looking for young people to explain to me what their experiences were around HIV infection, how did they get infected, what was their experience learning their diagnosis, how have they experienced disclosure, support and care, what are their challenges in managing our life with HIV/AIDS, what are their reproductive and health needs, how do they practice prevention, and then what are their hopes for the future. So findings, I had 9 young storytellers, more female than male, no surprises there. I was lucky because the method that I actually used for getting the participants is that they would identify me, they had to look for me, and then they would recommend somebody in the same age that they thought would be willing to share their story with me. So it just turned out that I actually had 4 young people that had gotten HIV through mother-to-child transmission and 5 from sexual transmission. 4 were from rural villages, 5 were in urban towns, 4 had dropped out of school, rather were in school, 5 were not in school. I had almost half and half single teenagers and those that were actually parenting. So really it helped, it turned out that it would allow me to compare their stories or their experiences on so many levels that I hadn't anticipated I would find. And the study was designed, or the 73 questions were designed around five research questions. So when we're analyzing the results, we analyze the results by theme, by research question. So I'm going to share with you briefly what the highlights were for each research question. So in trying to understand the experience around how did they get HIV, how have they experienced diagnosis and disclosure, I very quickly learned that for the rural teenagers who got sex through sexual transmission, is that it was basically poverty. One young lady, Irene, was an orphan who was orphaned at 13, and she had to take care of six siblings. So for her, the quickest way out was to look for the next man on the village that was interested in her and get married so she could be able to take care of her siblings. Another, Abigail, she grew up very, very poor, and her desire for that 1 year before infection was to have a piece of bread, have meat to eat, and have shelter. So again, she kept looking for that one young man who would provide that. So poverty is huge in rural countries and how people get HIV/AIDS. Then I also learned regarding diagnosis that the mode of transmission, whether it's been through your through mother-to-child transmission or through sexual experiences, actually shapes the way young people look at the experience. For young people, for the children who got HIV from their parents, the way they received diagnosis actually impacted them right into young adulthood. They go to a counselor, they are 8 or 7 or 5, and they tell them you have HIV and you will die, but you're not going to die now. You have HIV, but it's manageable. So growing up from that age, realizing that they might not live to be 16, for some of them was very, very traumatizing. So that struck me as something for health professionals to think about. How do you deliver diagnosis to a young child? And then I also learned that their diagnosis and disclosure experiences, those that have gotten HIV as very young people, have a continued need for counseling, because when you tell me I can grow up with HIV/AIDS, I think at a very young age they don't quite understand what the implication of HIV is until they go to school and they want to start dating, and then diagnosis means something different, and then they want to get married until they want to disclose. So it's sort of their reality about living with HIV changes as they get older, so there is a consistent need for them to be in relationship with health professionals that help them redefine their experience over time. The interesting thing about young people that get HIV as young kids, because they stay in counseling for a long time, they already grow up with a resolve that they have a responsibility to prevent the spread of HIV/AIDS, which was not the case with teenagers that had gotten HIV as young adults. So I found that very interesting. For question two was, well, how do you think and feel about HIV in your bodies? Again, the younger people who got HIV as kids constantly struggled with understanding that they will never live a normal life. Three of them, especially Clint and Regina, had been hospitalized for suicide attempts twice in their young lives, and they still continued to struggle even through the interview, thinking they would never have a normal life. So again, the need for continued support for them was key. Interestingly, for other people, they believed HIV was manageable and they could live a long, productive life with HIV. So their responses in how they felt varied across. The third question was, how do you think and feel about the support and care that you received? All of them generally showed that they benefited from support, whether it was from clergy, whether it was from peers, whether it was from counselors. The materials that they received was very key for their survival. The one thing though that they shared that they thought was lacking was that at HIV service centers there was no confidentiality and privacy at the clinics, because they sit in long lines to wait to be seen. And in some of these little towns, the clinic is in the center of town. They don't want their peers to know they have HIV. So some of them would actually walk for maybe 8 hours on the day they are going for clinic to the next town, because they would rather go to a town where nobody will see them. And then they also say that they know that they have friends that who are in their sick circles that have never gone to get checked because they don't want to be seen at the health center and be associated with HIV. So that was important. The rural youth, however, especially the young mothers, felt a sense of isolation from the support and care because in urban towns, there's generally support groups for the living with HIV/AIDS. That does not happen in the rural groups. And they felt, one, being a young mother takes you away from the social circle. Being HIV makes it even worse. So they were sure that it would be really, really nice if in the rural areas they would organize formalized support for them. Then another question was, how do you think and feel about reproductive health? Those that got HIV as young people at that time were not sexually active, but they were all sufficiently healthy to be sexually active and they expressed interest in partners for life and they knew what they needed to do. They would go for HIV counseling. So I thought that was interesting. Those that were older and were already parenting struggled because especially the young women, some of them have had two kids and they explain that it takes a toll to be pregnant and have HIV/AIDS in resource-constrained places. But then there's a cultural need in Uganda for a woman to show a woman who there has to be a child. So they constantly struggled with wanting to change life partners or finding somebody who would not push them to have a child because they didn't feel like their bodies would take a 9-month strain with HIV. And the last question was, how do you feel about preventive practices? All of them know that it's important and that you have a responsibility to protect other people, but the female felt powerless to continue to negotiate condom use with their male partners because they said even when they disclosed, some of their male partners thought they were using that as an excuse not to use a condom. And at that point, they don't know what to do. So they still will have sex without using a condom, so they are spreading AIDS, but they can't negotiate condom use. A very important thing that struck me was that all these young people struggled with food and adhering to medication. So if they give them medication, it's very, very hard on their bodies and stomachs. They throw up, they cannot manage the medication. So two of them had actually stopped the medication at about three different times in the course of the medication, which is all of us here who have done a little about HIV medication, or that cannot be good for their health. So that's very, very huge. Then two of the young people in the rural areas continue to have sex as a means of survival. That's what they do, they are sex workers. And again, they struggle to explain to their sexual partners that condom use is important for them not to spread HIV/AIDS. But because they need to meet their basic needs, they cannot stop trading sex for money. So what I learned was that really unmet basic needs influence the choices that young people make, even though they're trying to stop the spread of HIV/AIDS. They weigh the balance between survival, meeting basic needs, and stopping the spread of HIV/AIDS. Then I was also struck about secondary prevention. Like I said, if half of the teenagers don't work, or they do little odd jobs, some of them used to do hard labor jobs, but as they've been on medication over time, they have had to do less body-constraining, energy-type jobs. So they do not have a way to survive. So they usually will resort to risk behavior, not because they don't know what they ought to be doing, but they need to survive. So really having secondary prevention programs that help meet those basic needs is very key for rural teenagers. Implications for public health. A young woman who has a child who is 24 years old and a young woman who is HIV but is a single parent have very, very different needs. Oftentimes in resource-constrained areas, because of that, we don't design interventions to meet those needs, but they're very, very different. Then teenagers in rural locations and teenagers in urban locations, again, have very different needs, different resources. So again, the young people are very, very clear about designing interventions that match up to different groups within the HIV infection circle of young people. And then again, the need for nutrition assistance, because as soon as you put them on that medication, they're supposed to stay on it for life. If they backtrack or don't do a good job, you're actually compromising their health more especially if their viral load was not to a place where they needed antiretroviral medication. So that was very key, and they would say that. They'll say, you know, you're putting a bullet on my head if you give me medication, and you're telling me if I don't consistently take it, I get resistant to the drug, but I'm sick for 6 hours of a day, and I have nothing to eat. So they would prefer that you don't put them on medication until they are too sick to require medication, or if you do, ensure that there is food for them to eat to be able to adhere to medication. And again, developmentally appropriate mental health resources. If I get my diagnosis at 5, all I know is that I have a debilitating disease, but I might not die in 5 years. And then I go to secondary school, and I'm choosing the boy to go to the dance, and something might happen, and then all of a sudden HIV means something different. Now I have to disclose, now I'll be rejected. And then I want to get married. Some of them say, well, I want to get married to somebody who has HIV. And then some say, well, if I get married to somebody who has HIV, then I'm responsible for bringing somebody in the world that has HIV. Feeling the way I'm feeling, I don't want to be responsible for having another kid feel like that. And others feel, well, if there's somebody who has HIV and who is not HIV positive and they don't care marrying me, why not? So they struggle with what this is going to be for them as they grow older. So really have continuing to help them understand what their diagnosis implies as they grow older was key. I was very, very lucky to have these young people sit with me for hours and tell their stories. I had never done this kind of research before, but it was so telling. And then having them come back the next day and say, you know what, I thought about something else. What do you think? Like, no, you get to tell me. It was very, very, some of them actually thanked me because they were like, you know what, I have never been able to talk to anybody about this. So I want to come back every day and tell you something that I remember. I don't know if it's going to help you, but at least it helps me. So it was very, very nice. I had a wonderful mentor and ethics committee, Dr. Jacqueline, then my mother and sister in the audience. They're always my support team as we go in the villages. My friend Michelle, they're always telling me this can be done and we can reach out. And for today's listener, thank you so much for listening about teenagers in Uganda and what their experiences have been.